Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
You're listening to A Slice of Cheese with Jenny Linford on Food FM. Savour the crunch of Peter's Yard sourdough crackers. Available at Tesco, Waitrose, Sainsbury's, Asda, Morrisons, Ocado, Amazon and specialist food retailers.
To find out more about Food FM and our content, go to foodfmradio.com.
Hello, welcome to A Slice of Cheese, the Food FM radio series that celebrates the world of cheese. I'm Jenny Linford, a food writer and cheese enthusiast, the author of Great British Cheeses. Cheese is a delicious and fascinating food, and we're setting out to explore this remarkable food and share the stories of the people who make, sell and love it. While we often talk about tradition in the world of cheese, it's also a place of innovation and creativity. For this episode, I talked to James Rutter, Managing Director of Paxton Whitfield, about innovation in Britain's cheese scene. Dairy farmer David Finley of The Ethical Dairy about his cow with calf approach, and Amy Bryce of Freshly Ground PR and cheesemonger James Grant of No. 2 Pound Street about their new collaborative initiative, The Real Cheese Project.
Online, on smart speakers and on Listen Again, this is Food FM.
This week, on A Slice of Cheese, we're looking at the idea of innovation in the world of cheese. And I have someone with me who's very well placed to tell me about this. James Rutter, Managing Director of Paxton and Whitfield. Hello, James.
Hi, Jenny.
James, thank you for taking the time to come and talk to us. I mean, I was interested because, you know, cheese is often presented in terms of tradition as, you know, historic cheeses that have been made in a place for a long time. But what I also thought is actually there is an awful lot of sort of innovation in the world of cheese. Is that something that you're very well placed at Paxton's, you've got a big overview because you work with so many cheesemakers. Is that something that you would agree with?
Yes. I mean, there's been a huge increase in the number of cheesemakers making artisanal, speciality, farm-based cheeses, whatever you want to call them, over the last 30 or 40 years in the UK, and that's all really been driven through innovation, I would say, rather than by tradition. A lot of the that innovation has been driven either by passion, people that felt that they wanted to produce or make something of incredibly high quality, potentially inspired by what they had experienced on the continent, or by necessity, you know, farmers looking to try and add value to their milk through their innovation, and cheese is a way of them being able to do that. So yeah, I'd say that the UK cheese industry has really benefited from innovation, you know, over the last 30 or 40 years.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because I think when one goes to a beautiful cheese shop like Paxton's or Neil's Yard Dairy, you know, you see this array of cheeses. And I think what perhaps people don't realise is that, you know, yes, there are sort of classic cheeses, let's say like Cheddar and Stilton, which have, a long history of cheeses of that name. But equally, when you're looking at those cheeses, a lot of those cheeses are actually relatively recent. They've been created by somebody. I mean, I was thinking of Martin Gott of St. James's, who makes a cheese called St. James, and many other cheeses, actually. But that's cheese that he creates those cheeses, doesn't he? Even though he's using classic cheese-making techniques, they are his creations.
Completely, yep. The St. James is, you know, one of those cheeses that wouldn't exist if it wasn't for Martin, because it's being produced as a result of his interest and his experience, you know, working both for Graham Kirkham, who makes a very traditional cheese, and for Mary Holbrook, who made a sort of less traditional British cheese, I suppose. And he took those experiences and his passion for farming, animal husbandry, and went back to Cumbria and made something completely unique. But I think if we sort of take a step back Jenny and have a look at the two sort of pillars of British cheese, you know, cheddar and Stilton. Both of those cheeses are PDO. They're both protected, but cheddar in particular, there's a whole range of quality within that brand, and the PDO doesn't necessarily serve to manage that quality on a very specific basis. It's quite a broad PDO.
A PDO is a protected designation of origin, and it sort of stipulates rules about how a cheese is made and where it's made. You know, is a term that's used a lot in the cheese world.
So yes, you know, you mentioned if you go into a cheese shop like Paxton and Whitfield and you see these array of cheddars, you know, we're talking about a very small part of a very small section of the cheddars that are produced within the UK, and there's a huge range of quality and reasons for that range of quality and purposes, you know, behind that one cheese style that all fit within the PDO, which is a West Country farmhouse cheddar. And you can make a West Country farmhouse cheddar in Devon, for example. You could make it partially by machine. It can be formed in blocks. So, you know, they aren't necessarily the cheeses that businesses like Paxton and Whitfield are purchasing. So potentially we talk about those less as a result of that. So, you know, but yet those cheeses that we do sell, the farmhouse cheddars that we sell are long-standing. You know, Jamie Montgomery produces a very traditional cheddar in Somerset from his own milk that's wrapped in cloth, you know, sealed with lard and matured for over 12 months. So but there's no protection on that necessarily. There is a slow food procedure which documents those types of traditional recipes, but there isn't necessarily a form of protection. So it does give scope for other cheesemakers to be able to innovate. But yet there are existing frameworks outside of the PDO, I suppose, that can sort of guide the cheesemakers as well.
Interesting. I mean, I think one thing that struck me is, I'm thinking of cheddar, actually, it lends itself, is that I've seen so many different flavoured cheddars. I remember the same thing happened with sausages in Britain decades ago. There was a specialist sausage shop set up, and it was such a clever idea because it took sausages, which at that time were very low quality on the whole, and it made them with good meat, which was like, and that was innovative in itself in a way. But then what was clever, they also did flavoured sausages. So it did things like sort of, you know, prune and Armagnac, and I don't know, or sort of French or Italian style garlic and fennel sausage. And I thought what was clever about that was that people in Britain really knew sausages. And then they had these flavour variations, basically. So it was stayed within a format that was comfortable and familiar. That's a sausage. I like sausages. But you can try it in different ways. And I feel that with cheddar, I see flavoured cheddars. And it seems to me to have that thing where, you know, it's a cheddar. So that's nice. And you know what that cheddar is. But this one has got, you know, black pepper in it or wild garlic. So it allows, you know, it allows something fresh, I suppose, and new, but within that familiarity of a cheese that you do know.
It's an interesting thought, the idea of cheddar as a brand, you know, because you can, so I mentioned a little bit, there is a PDO there that's quite broad and allows you know, a fairly broad spectrum of cheese to be made that are called, you know, to be called West Country farmhouse cheddar. And then there's a slow food procedure that looks to protect some more of the traditional cheddar recipes that are being made by a handful of cheesemakers in Somerset. But the brand cheddar, I mean, you could make any cheese and call it a cheddar. The name cheddar has no form of protection. And I suppose that where there are no rules stipulated, opportunity exists to you know, be able to innovate and create, whether you think it's for better or for worse.
Something I notice as someone who's written about the British food scene for decades is a sort of open-mindedness, and I think partly because we're not as constrained by our food traditions. I mean, perhaps constrained is the wrong word, but I was thinking we don't have such a strong sense of our food culture as some other countries. Do you see, because Paxton's, you sell, you know, cheeses from around the world, not just Britain. Do you see cheesemakers in other countries you know, creating, do cheesemakers in let's say Italy or Switzerland or France, do they make new cheeses? Do they, in the way that we discussed with Martin Gott, does that also happen? Is that something that you see at Paxton's as well?
No, it does. It does happen on the continent. I mean, I think that because there is there's less engagement with the PDO system in the UK. You know, customers don't really place an incredible amount of value on it here in England. Whereas, if you go to the continent, you know they like to buy Conte, they like to buy Brie de Meaux, as a brand, and maybe there's less emphasis placed on the cheesemakers or the producer, and it's really then down to the cheesemonger or the shop to select what they feel is the best. There's a benefit to that, you know, where you have fairly tight controls or rules around how a particular cheese can be made, you know, it really helps you maintain quality. So generally speaking, within like say Conte, in my opinion there's a much smaller breadth of quality in Conte than there is say in cheddar. You know, cheddar, there's a huge breadth of quality because of that lack of control. It doesn't really stipulate exactly how these cheeses should be made, and therefore you've got people trying to serve different sections of the market at different price points and ultimately at different qualities. Whereas Conte or Brie de Meaux, you know, the rules and the regulations around how you produce that style of cheese are much clearer. So that's good from some perspective, because it protects the quality to the degree in which they're documented of those particular styles of cheese. But ultimately, it also creates challenges because if you're a large producer or a small producer, you all have to produce cheese to the same list of rules. So you get less diversity, and therefore there's less opportunity, I feel, particularly for smaller producers that are producing cheeses in those regions. It's a bit of a double-edged sword, to be honest with you.
Yes, yeah. It has its pros and cons, basically, doesn't it? It's so interesting. It's one of the interesting bits about your job, James, because is it exciting when a cheesemaker that you know and admire from years of working in the world of cheese in Britain says, oh, actually, perhaps they're going to try a new milk, you know, that's new to them. Perhaps they've bought some sheep or some goats and they've got an idea for cheese, and they say, oh, we've got this cheese project, it's going to be a new cheese. Is that exciting for you to, you know, when a new cheese emerges in the British cheese world?
Yeah, I think it's a good, I think, you know, innovation is where, you know, creativity, opportunity and problem solving all sort of meet together. And I think as to whether or not it's exciting really depends on, you know, how those three elements have sort of combined to create the particular cheese. But I'd say, largely speaking, yes, you know, I think it's a good sign for the industry if there are more new cheeses being launched, more new cheeses being created, because it keeps things fresh, it can keep customers engaged. But then also on the flip side, you don't like to see innovation for maybe the cheesemaker's facing a challenging time, they need to produce more cheese, they're trying to solve problems. That can be a negative as well. You know, it can detract from what they're doing, it can be, you know, rushed. So I think it really depends on the cheese itself, Jenny. You know, I think if there's, you know, for creativity, excitement, you know, going into the cheese, then that's a really positive thing.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose perhaps I was thinking, Rosalie, that if someone brings you a new cheese and it's really good, and there are lots of examples that you and I could both think of cheeses being created, especially by new cheesemakers, as well as people who've been around, who literally, you know, people who've fallen in love with cheese, they've started making it, and they hit a really good cheese. They find a good cheese recipe and they bring it along. And then I suppose for you as the retailer, you have to decide whether to stock it, you've got to explain it to your customer who won't know what it is, you've got to try and, there must be quite a process that goes from your point of view, quite a lot of work, if you've got to get behind something new and send it out into the world.
Completely, completely. But there is a lot of excitement in that for us as well as a retailer, you know, to be able to bring new cheeses onto the counter and to be able to taste them with customers and to be able to get the feedback from the customers and feed that back to the cheesemaker. You know, that whole feedback loop from cheesemaker to cheesemonger to customer, back to cheesemonger, back to cheesemaker is such an important tool, I think, for the cheesemaker to be able to shape the cheese and to understand how it's being received on the counter. Because in a lot of cases, you know, those cheesemakers will produce those cheeses and send them out into the wide world, and they may not ever hear again. So that working in collaboration, both with the customer and the cheesemaker, is definitely part of the excitement and interest from us working on new cheeses.
And actually, so new cheeses, James, I mean, you've been at Paxton's, which, you know, and is a wonderful, very eminent and historic British cheese shop. I notice is that you yourself have created a new cheese yourself that you were selling at Paxton's. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, we so in the run up to Christmas, we used coffee in the maturation of a cheese for the first time. I haven't, or we haven't as a business, ever used coffee in the maturation of a cheese, but an opportunity presented itself to us. There's a local coffee roasters who really high quality coffees, and they had we had a meeting with them, and we decided that we would play around to see what we could do, really just to have some fun. We both wanted to explore, I suppose, what is possible, what could be achieved, and we ended up producing this cheese called Caldi, which is a hard goat's milk cheese that we bring into the business with completely rindless, without a rind. And we started to wash the cheese, and we were growing the rinds on these cheeses anyway, but we were washing the cheese, and when the cheese became a little bit tacky, we basically just rubbed some coffee grounds over the rind and then left it to mature for sort of six to 12 weeks. And actually what we found was that there was a really nice balance of flavor. The coffee wasn't overpowering. It definitely became more pronounced as you tasted it, you know, closer to the rind, but it was always in balance with the flavors of the cheese. And there's a really nice milky floral, freshness about the cheese, and it just worked really well with this sort of fruity, slightly earthy coffee going on in the background. So we tasted the cheese together with the coffee company called Rave Coffee, and they really liked it, and they said, look, could you make us some cheese for Christmas so that we can promote it to our customers? So we did, and it was a real success. Yeah, we've just put the first batch into production post Christmas, and that should be ready in the next few weeks. And I anticipate that it'll be part of our lineup all year round. So
does that come out, James, because you like coffee yourself? I mean, was it you wanting to work with this coffee company? You know, did you two? I don't know. Did you and the guy from the coffee company hit it off and think, let's try and do something together?
Yeah, exactly. It was just about those. It's just about those connections, I suppose. And yeah, I love coffee. And you know, I'm buying coffee regularly from Rave. It's the local coffee roaster to where I live. And I met David, who heads up their marketing. We got on, and we thought, let's see if we can have some fun. And we didn't really know where it was going to lead. It was more of just more of a sort of project of interest for both of us. But when we created Caldi and we tasted it, we thought, hang on a minute, you know, there's something really interesting about this. And David felt like he could do something at the back end of 2023, and the feedback was brilliant. So we're continuing.
And Caldi, we should explain, is named after there's a legend of coffee origin, that Caldi was a goat herd in Ethiopia, where coffee is indigenous, it grows in that part of the world, and that he noticed that his goats were particularly lively after they'd eaten the berries of a tree, and that's the legend. And so he tried it, and that was coffee. And that's, is that right, James, that story?
That is right, and we couldn't believe our luck once we'd made the cheese. You know, it wasn't really in our plans to call it Caldi. We hadn't even discussed, you know, it was a cheese of no name for quite a while, and yeah, just fortunate that the goat's milk cheese really worked well, and David mentioned about the legend, and it just seemed very fitting.
Yeah, very fitting. That's brilliant, because I thought perhaps you'd rather clearly thought, oh, okay, let's take goat, because goat's tied in with coffee, but that was just serendipity at work then.
Completely, yeah. I mean, the whole thing was really for us to have fun, you know, both as a business. It's great for the team here at Paxton's as well to sort of experiment, and you know, sometimes things work and sometimes things don't, but no matter what, we always learn something. So you know, we're always on the lookout.
I mean, it's interesting because you've got, you know, one of the things you've invested in, James, as in your role as managing director of Paxson's, is those, that new maturing unit or space. And that presumably allows you space to carry out an experiment like that. Is that correct?
Completely, yes. Yeah, and the facilities and, you know, the working practices as well. You know, had we not moved into the new maturation rooms, you know, I doubt we would have ended up, you know, experimenting with Caldi. But I could say the same about, you know, a number of the cheeses that we've launched as well over the past sort of 18 months to 2 years. So we're really looking to use the maturation rooms to work alongside cheesemakers to find solutions to problems that they may have, or, you know, potentially just have some fun and see if we can learn more about the cheese and flavor and texture. And we've had some great results coming out there, including cheeses that have won World Cheese Awards, you know, just within the last 18 months. So I'm really excited about what the future holds.
Did you go and see how people were reacting to it out of interest?
Yeah, definitely. You know, that's part of the fun, isn't it? I suppose getting feedback from customers and being able to act on that and you know, improve or change things. It's a big part of it. I mean, I would say it's my baby. It's it really is a collaboration, I suppose, both as Paxton's as a business, because the team in the cheese rooms, you know, did a brilliant job developing the process and the sort of maturation recipe, as it were, to get the coffee to integrate nicely onto the rind. And David's done some brilliant jobs in selecting, because the coffee will change with every batch. So we used a coffee from Rwanda for the first batch. The second batch, we're going to use a coffee from Ethiopia, and that batch of coffee will we'll cycle throughout the cheese's lifetime, so that there's always something, you know, slightly different about the cheese when customers come back to it. So, you know, it's been a real team effort, I suppose. But yeah, no, incredibly exciting when customers feedback and say they like it and they come back and buy a second piece. You know, it's really.
And I think what's interesting in a way is that your customers are up for trying something like that. Coffee and cheese, you might think, oh, that sounds a bit weird or a bit odd, but if they're game to give it a go and then keen enough to buy it, if you're going to put it on your, if it's going to be a regular item, then presumably you're selling it. So that's an impressive thing as well about your customers too, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. The cheese is the star, right? And that mm-hmm. was something
yes.
that I was really keen to ensure, that, you know, it's the flavour of the cheese that is up front and takes centre stage, and any additional flavours are just there to provide, you know, additional complexity or additional interest.
Yeah.
So, you know, the feedback from a lot of the customers, you know, you think, oh, coffee and cheese, that seems odd, but when they taste it, they go, oh, I'd like more coffee. You know,
I found that very heartening, actually, that you've having fun and you've made this new cheese and it works, and, you know, and there's another addition to the sort of the British cheese scene. Lovely to talk to you. Thank you for your time,
James.
Thank
you, Jenny. Appreciate that.
Online, on smart speakers, and on Listen Again, this is Food FM.
You're listening to A Slice of Cheese with Jenny Linford on Food FM. Savour the crunch of Peter's Yard sourdough crackers. Available at Tesco, Waitrose, Sainsbury's, Asda, Morrisons, Ocado, Amazon, and specialist food retailers.
This week on A Slice of Cheese, we're looking at the idea of innovation in the world of cheese. And I have with me today David Finlay, dairy farmer of The Ethical Dairy. Hello, David.
Hello, Jenny.
David, I wanted to have you on this episode because I was interested in your story, really, in hearing your story. From what I understand, you went back to a conventional dairy farm, but then you decided to do something different. Perhaps do tell me in your own words what it was you've set out to do or setting out to do.
Okay, well, I came home 37 years ago from farm consultancy. So, my message to farmers had been intensification is the name of the game, and technology is the way forward. And so I came home with very much that mindset.
So you did come back to a family farm, did you?
Oh, yes, family farm. I'll be third generation here, but we've been farming in this area cheese-making dairy farmers probably for 150 years on two different farms, and then before that for some time into the mists of the past. So, yeah, we've been farming for a while. So we are very much a part of the farming community here, and the family has been, you know, we'll be related to a lot of the local farmers. Came back to shake the place up. We started to put on more fertilizers, put on more stock, get better, bigger, better machinery and all that stuff. And it kind of, you know, I was feeling a bit uncomfortable with it because it was brought a lot of challenges in terms of the animal welfare. But, you know, just thought, well, everybody's doing it, so you get on with it, suck it up, and it'll get better. Anyway, my wife 31 years ago, and she came here for non-agricultural background and was pretty shocked by modern farming. And so that was kind of a bit of a wake-up call, but I don't think anything changed as a result of that. But what we did was we then went into ice cream and tourism, and so we had visitors on the farm coming in, doing farm tours and all the rest of it. And I think, again, you know, that this was another sort of a nudge into a different farming approach, was from the reaction of visitors to particularly the cow-calf separation, which was surprised me. I mean, I thought, well, you know, of all the things to be react to, the one was a standard in the dairy industry was take the calf away because we needed the milk. And that clearly was not something that particularly the women visitors were at all comfortable with. Anyway, that again highlighted to me the way that agriculture, farming, and modern farming had moved away from the public's concept of how the food was being produced. So again, you know, that was another sort of like a step in that journey to reassess what we were doing and how we were doing it. So that was 30 years ago. We diversified. Then 25 years ago, having spent 10 years intensifying and not being comfortable with it and getting a bit of criticism from my family, we looked at organic and started the organic conversion. And the only reason I stuck with organic was because it led to a crash in farm productivity because we took away our fertilizers and pesticides. So, and we really didn't know what we were doing. I stuck with it only because we were making organic ice cream at the time. And there was only two organic ice cream manufacturers in the whole of the UK. And the other one was even smaller than we were. So I stuck with organic, and otherwise I'd have packed it in because it gave us access to a UK-wide organic ice cream market. And we were selling organic ice cream from Milo White to Shetland on the back of that. It was quite incredible how organic was really flying at that time. That was the late 90s, early 2000s. And then, of course, Foot and Mouth came along, and we lost half of our market, which was on our doorstep as the countryside closed with Foot and Mouth. And, had to rethink things very abruptly. So organic, we were 10 years, once we were about 10 years into organic, we were getting good production, good outcomes, good, where our stocking levels were back to the levels where we were using fertilizers. You know, the whole farm started to work, and you're thinking, wow, this is starting to work now. And on the back of that, we kind of thought, went back to this criticism that we had from the public about cow and calf separation, and started to look into it and thinking, well, here's the farm, we've given it nature a chance and tried to work with nature, and it seems to be working. What about the cows? Can we do the same thing with the cows if we give them a more natural world instead of taking their calves away at birth? If we leave the calves with the cows, will they thank us for it? And we started to do research into that, looked at what was being done elsewhere in Europe. We went across to the Netherlands and saw the guys there, smaller scale, the 30, 40 cow herds, organic, where they were leaving calves with their mothers for 3 months there. And we thought, okay, we sent the team across and they had a look as well. And everybody came back and said, yeah, sure, we can do that. But it wasn't that easy. And we're now 8 years into cow with calf dairying. When I say it wasn't easy, we thought the cows would thank us for leaving the calves with them. But they weren't. They weren't thankful at all. They were stressed. They wouldn't let their milk down in the parlour. They got mastitis. They went lame. They had never seen anything quite as bad. The calves were running circles around us because we hadn't got the building set up properly to manage them, and the fencing of the field, the whole thing. It was a nightmare. After 5 months, packed it up and said, it doesn't work. It's far worse than what we were doing before. The industry was right. It's not good for the animal welfare, and it's certainly bad for our welfare. We were stressing. The cows were stressing. Everything was awful. And what we figured was that the cows always had been used to, they didn't like it, but they'd been used to getting 24 hours with their calf. Then they'd come, be brought into the parlour for milking. They'd come out of the parlour and the calf was gone. And that was the routine. They didn't like it. And some bawled for days afterwards. But I mean, suddenly the calf was there. And okay, they got another day with the calf. And then another day. And they were going, okay, you bastards, we know you're going to do it. One day, when are you going to do it? It's this sentiency that we kind of underestimated. We didn't really allow for what the cows were feeling. They hadn't got the memo. You know? They were going, what is going on? So the association then would be with the parlour. We brought them into the parlour. They wouldn't let the milk down because they were stressed, because they didn't know if they were going to join the calf again. And that led to mastitis and led to lameness. And we were stressed too. The whole system was stressed. What happened next was my daughter was a vet, and she'd been speaking to one of her tutors from Glasgow Vet School, Professor David Logue. And he was quite fascinated by this, what we'd been doing. And they sent a student down to look at the data that we collected and crunch the numbers and come up with a report. And the report from the student said, well, yeah, it could work, you know, if we could get these other things sorted out. So that was the challenge, was back again. Could we do it? Could we go back to it? And thought, okay, we'll give it one more go. 2016, went back to it, but we were better organized this time. We got the layout of the buildings and the fields, everything was ready. We were ready for these calves, and we weren't going to change and chop and change anything. We were just going to start leaving the calves with the mothers and let it run in a way that sort of the consistency, because we were, again, the first time around, we were changing it, trying to get the cows to let their milk down. So we changed the way the routines and the twice a day milking, once a day milking. Cows are worse than humans. They really do not like change. So we said, right, this time we're going to get it right. But things had moved on. I mean, 4 years, this was the first time we went into a brand new building with there'd been no cows in it before. Therefore, was no disease, there was no pathogens in the building. Second time, the 4 years of cows and the pathogens were there. And previously, when you took the calves away, you took them into a sterile environment, into clean buildings, away from the cows, away from all these disease challenges, because the calves are very vulnerable and the defense systems take a long time to build up. By leaving them with the cows in the building, you were exposing them to these diseases that the cows were resistant to, but the calves certainly weren't. And we ran into all kinds of problems the second time around. But we worked, I mean, the vets were great. They came along, they were fascinated by what we were doing. They did a lot of testing and swabbing and gave us good advice. And we got our management sorted out, particularly colostrum was key, giving the calves extra colostrum because they were in this artificial, inside the building was an artificial environment where the pathogens had built up and all this kind of thing. So we got changed our management system, changed everything we did. And so it brings it back. It was very similar to when we did organic. You know, the first few years, we didn't know what we were doing. We were kind of thrashing around, making mistakes. and it wasn't working. But after a while, we started to get our heads around it, managed it better, understood what we were doing, and it worked for us. So in a similar, very similar way, that the cow with calf thing is a system change. It's not just leaving the calves with the mothers. Great, calves, mothers look after the calves, job done. No, totally different. Everything changes. The attitude of the cows changes, the relationship of us and the cows and the calves, the stress levels, and then the disease. And of course, if you've got stress, you've got disease, it makes the whole thing far worse. So it's about understanding the whole system of managing this cow with calf, whereby stress is plays such a big part of the health and well-being of the animals and the people working there.
I mean, it sounds, you know, very challenging, but you obviously stuck with it. How long do they have with their calves then?
Inevitably, food production will be a compromise. You know, we're trying to see where the line, we draw the line between what, where we get what we need and the cow gets what she needs, but we're, neither of us get, it's not perfect for either of us. And it's been again, very interesting. So what we've plumped for is it's around about 5 months. Once the calf is strong and is able to fend for itself, and we do all, again, you know, it's getting back to the stress thing, you know. So we try to make sure that at every stage of this, as the cow and calf transition through around the calendar, that the changes are introduced gradually, so we minimize stress, and that is so important. If the cow is stressed, she won't let her milk down. If the calf is stressed, they will get disease. So stress is so important at every stage. So we say, right, at 5 months, we've already started the process of separation, because we start separating overnight from about 2 months. Once the calf has had 24-hour access to its mum for 2 months, then they start drinking a lot of milk. And the cow, by this stage, she's peak milk production and she's starting to decline. And by the time you get to 3 to 4 months, the calf will drink everything and the cow can hang on to it. So she does, and we get nothing. So it is important, once you're into month three, is that you start cow-calf separation overnight. Just overnight, the calf gets back to its mum during the day. And you know, it's very quickly, everybody has accepted this as the new norm. By month five, we then say, right, what we did in the early days was just shut the gate and said, right, calves, you're not getting in now. But there was 48 hours of pandemonium, absolute uproar. It was you couldn't think in the building. It was just a roar. So what we've discovered, these nose tabs, those little clever little nose tabs, just sit in the nose. They don't break skin or anything. And when the calf goes to reach for the cow's teat, they lift their upper lip, and that pushes the little tab that knocks the teat away. It's so frustrating for them, but it is just frustrating. It isn't stressful, and we leave these tabs in for, it takes a few seconds to put them in and just a few seconds to take them back out again. But it stops the calf from suckling, so the calf still has the physical contact. The routine's the same. We then start bringing the cows in the afternoon for milking, because we'll only be milking once a day when the calves are with them, because the calf is doing the other milking. So it's not doing that now, so we bring them in twice, the second time in the afternoon. But otherwise, we leave the routine exactly the same. And the calves, eventually, by the end of 10 days, are saying, well, what's the point? You know, in that overnight separation, it's gradually strengthened the papier bonds and starting to break the maternal bond. It also allows the calf to get hungry, because when it's got a 24-hour access to warm mum's milk, it's not going to eat a lot of solids. So its rumen doesn't develop if you leave them on 24/7. So we find that overnight separation from month 3 to 5 helps the rumen develop, so that when we finally wean the calf. The rumen is fully developed. The calf doesn't stress, doesn't get hungry because it's got its access to its own feed, its own silage, and so on. So at the end of 10 days, we don't let the calves in with the mums at all, but they're right next door. If they're outside, there's a fence. If they're indoors, it's just a rail between the cows and the calves, and there is nothing, not a squeak. Everybody's given up for a stage. And so it's stress-free. And you know, it's common sense. You don't want the calves to stress because they'll get ill. You know, everything, it's just learning how to work with the animals, work with their nature more, better. Maybe not perfect, but it's... And as a result, what we're finding, this is the core of the thing, because people say, well, wait a minute, how much milk are these calves drinking? How can that ever be a business proposition? They're drinking all your milk. And you say, yeah, they drink, while they're with their mums that first 5 months, they're drinking 2/3 of the milk, sure. And before, back in the good old bad old days, we were giving the calves, when we took them away at birth, we gave the calves formula milk. They weren't even getting real milk. And then when we were organic, we had to give them real milk. We had to give them a lot more for longer, but it was real milk when we were organic. And then now, so the calves went from 280 litres of formula milk to 420 litres of organic milk. And now they're drinking between 2,000 and 2,500 litres of my organic milk. And they say, how can that possibly work? Well, it does. And it's very interesting. What happens is that the calves, because they're drinking so much milk, they're growing more than twice as fast as they were before. So in that first 6 months, they are growing twice as fast, which means that they are coming to maturity 6 to 8 months sooner than they did before. That means that that forage that they would have been eating in that last 6 to 8 months is now available to carry more cows. So we can increase our cow numbers by about 25% on the strength of getting the young stock turned over quicker. But the cows, the suckling, and maybe the welfare aspect, certainly the suckling, has meant that we are getting, instead of 4,500 litres from forage, which is a good target for any dairy farmer to get 4,500 litres from forage, we're getting 6,000 litres from forage. So we're getting more, 25% more milk, in fact, 30% more milk for per cow, and 25% more cows. But even though the calf is drinking 2/3 in that first half of the lactation, which is averages out at about just under 40%, so 40% of milk. Even though, so if you do the maths, 30% more milk, 25% more cows, less 40% to the calf, you're left with still more milk.
When did you start making cheese with your milk? Because it sounds like you've been very busy trying all sorts of changes. First the change to organic, then trying to have the calves with the mother for longer. So when did cheese making enter the picture as well?
Yes, well, cheese making. We come from a long line of cheese making raw milk, cheese making dairy farmers, because of course back in the day they didn't pasteurize. So we've been cheese making dairy farmers since the 1860s. As a kid, I helped with the milking and the buyers, but you weren't allowed in the cheese dairy. That was the cheese making herdsman. He did the cheese making and his family, but I wasn't allowed in. I just had to do the dirty work. And my nearest connection to cheese was eating the curd. You'd get salted curd from the cheddar making thrown in your direction occasionally, which we loved, probably because of the salt. So yes, we'll be making cheese. But we went back to the cheese making, and my dad, who's now 101 in a couple of weeks, he was delighted. We went back to cheese making. And we thought, well, we're now into this sort of thing about the microbiome, and we didn't want to. In fact, we were talking to a young man from Andalusia who designed cheese dairies. In fact, he designed our cheese dairy, as a favour. We were talking to him about the, you know, cheese and raw milk cheese, and he was right into raw milk cheese and the microbiome. And so we thought, yeah, this is where we need to be, because he said, look, you've got healthy soils, you've got healthy animals. You don't want to go and pasteurize. You're breaking that link of the that life cycle. A living link between your farm and the health of your farm and animals and the people who will consume your cheese. So we thought, yeah, that sounds makes sense to us. A lot of our customers now buy our cheese because it is unpasteurized. So we started making cheese in a small way in the ice cream dairy, but that was never going to work because you've no control over the environment at all. And you're having to move equipment around to make space for cheese making. So we this young fellow from Andalusia was visiting us on an exchange visit, and he part of his job was designing micro dairies for cheese makers in Andalusia, southern Spain. And he was staying with us. And by sheer coincidence, he had his laptop and AutoCAD, and he designed the cheese dairy that we make our cheese in now, Andres. So we started making cheese properly back in the 2019, with a view to supplying food service, because a lot of our customers do ice cream within food service and small retail outlets. We didn't want to go near the supermarkets because we knew we dealt with them. We're dealing with them, and they're not easy. We weren't in the volume market. We were in an artisan market, and that's not supermarkets. So we started scaling up in 2019. And I guess this ties very much back to the cow with calf, because it's all chicken and egg stuff, but really, one of the drivers for cow with calf and making it work was we knew there was a market there.
Tell me about the cheeses, because talk me through your cheese range.
We talked to some of the cheesemongers, and they said, well, we don't want any more cheddars. We've got plenty of them. Make something more interesting. So we kind of thought, well, okay, like what? So we take basic recipes and we make our versions of these types of cheeses.
Is your milk good for cheese making?
Again, the cow with calf brings another level of complexity, because not only do you have the variation of the seasons and the stage of lactation of the cows, but you also have the calf. And the impact of the calf, suckling the cow, if the cow has a choice, she will hold on to the butterfat. Some cows share their milk with us really well, and we get good butterfat milk from them. Other cows don't, and we get semi-skimmed milk, because the milk that the cow holds on to for her calf is the high butterfat milk. So we've split our herd into two, calving 6 months apart. And the reason we do that is the cows, once we take the calves away from the cows, the butterfat is about 5%, which is high for cheese making, but it's okay. Cows that are suckling, their butterfat milk averages about 1.8%, which is way too low. But if we have both herds milking together, we get an average of 4% butterfat, which is just about right for the type of protein in the milk, the balance of protein and butterfat in the milk, which makes good cheese most of the year. We just have short periods where the spring calving herd has been dried off, ready for spring calving, and you still have some cows, the cows suckling their calves, and at that point your butterfats crash, and we have to be inventive about so we make what we call skinny cheeses. We also, some of the very hard Parmesan type of cheese, they use a low butterfat milk, so we can kind of get around it.
Are the dairy farmers coming to see what you're doing? Do they take, you know, are they interested in what you're doing?
The industry as a whole came out against cow with calf. When we first started trialing back in 2012-13, there was a lot of press interest in what we were doing. And they then went to the industry to ask, what do they think? And there was generally a negative response based around management, based around animal welfare even, animal health. The vets were very sceptical. We have to change the way we farmed to adapt to meet these different challenges. And that has been the lesson we've learned. So do we get farmers coming here? The organic guys was kind of thinking, oh dear, if he can make this work, they're going to come to us first and say, well, if he can make it work, why aren't you doing it if you're such high welfare dairy farmers? So they didn't really like what we were doing. And one of my good friends said, you're setting the bar high, you know, in a good way. But we are getting, we're getting farmers coming from far and wide. We're getting from Sweden, France, where else? America. We're also involved. There's a lot of research going on in cow-calf work. And again, Sweden was one of the ones. Norway, New Zealand, Australia, America, Canada, all scientists getting involved and coming back to us because we're probably furthest along the road of what they'd consider to be a commercial scale, i.e. more than just 10 or a dozen cows. So that's good. And we get dairy farmers with Americans here last year. We've just had a visit from, we get quite a few farms down in the home counties come here because, again, they see a potential market on the doorstep for liquid milk, probably.
Absolutely fascinating. Thank you, David. I mean, I really appreciate you taking the time
You're
to
welcome.
Talk to me. Thank you. I'm a huge fan of Peter's Yard's sourdough crackers, and they go beautifully with cheese. All Peter's Yard crackers are made in small batches using quality natural ingredients and their sourdough starter, slowly fermented for 16 hours for award-winning flavour and crunch.
Online, on smart speakers, and on Listen Again, this is Food FM.
You're listening to A Slice of Cheese with Jenny Linford on Food FM. Savour the crunch of Peter's Yard sourdough crackers. Available at Tesco, Waitrose, Sainsbury's, Asda, Morrisons, Ocado, Amazon and specialist food retailers.
This week in A Slice of Cheese, we're looking at innovation in the world of cheese. And I have with me two guests who are part of a very interesting new project. I have Amy Bryce of Freshly Ground PR and James Grant of No. 2 Pound Street. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning, Jenny.
Good morning, James.
Good morning, Jenny.
I was very intrigued to hear about what you're up to. So let's try and explain to listeners what you are up to. Amy, perhaps just give us a little overview. You're setting up something called The Real Cheese Project, which is a great title. What is The Real Cheese Project?
So, yes, The Real Cheese Project is basically an organisation that's connecting the cheese world, the cheesemakers, the cheesemongers, with cheese lovers. We're a nation of cheese lovers, and we're only scratching the surface of what our country has to offer in terms of cheese. So we want to bring the sort of artisan cheese stories to the masses so that people have a better understanding of what cheeses are available, and change buying habits. So rather than just thinking going to the supermarket to buy cheeses, thinking about what you can get local to you, if you're traveling around, what might be sort of specific to that area. So we're really just trying to change people's understanding of what this country has to offer in terms of cheese.
A very laudable cause, yes. And James, I mean, you're a cheesemonger with a wonderful cheese shop at No. 2 Pound Street. So this, you know, this is obviously a cause close to your heart. And do you think that you need an organisation like this to try and tell that story and get people perhaps to understand the riches that we have got here in Britain?
Well, yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Jenny, for being with us today. We're so privileged to be with you, such a great writer as well. So thank you so much. I'd like to just to say that it's in the maths. There's 3% of the UK that are buying artisan cheese. 97% is buying industrial commercial cheese. The pendulum's got to change, not just for cheese, but for the well-being of our planet, the agroecology, etc. It's so important to champion this. Daily, weekly, in my dreams, all I think about is great artisan cheese, the hard work that these farmers put put into what they're doing to protect their livestock, to protect the land for us to enjoy our great cheeses. There's one particular farmer I should mention, which is Patrick Holden, who I hold very high up. And he did say once when we were organizing a competition last year with regards to cheddar, and he said, "And we are what we eat, what they ate." And I think it's so important to consider that what we eat comes from the ground upwards, and we are human. We need to really start focusing on good cheese. And if I can help with this new company, the Real Cheese Project, to swing the pendulum towards artisan farmhouse cheeses, we're winning. We're doing something great. So I'm so proud to be able to be working with Amy and Sam Bryce on this project, and my lovely wife Nicola, to help make a difference.
Well, I mean, I can hear your passion, James. And Amy, how did this project come about? I mean, I'm guessing that obviously you and your husband Sam, who we should definitely mention, this is a very much a co-founded project. It's Sam and Amy Bryce of Freshly Ground PR, James and Nicola Grant from Number 2 Pound Street. So obviously you must have known each other. It's quite a small world, the world of good cheese in Britain. Was it a conversation? Was it an idea that's been brewing for some time?
Well, James and Sam were in Bra last September hosting the
Great British. We should explain for
British.
The listeners. Yeah. Just explain that Bra... See, I think for people who don't know about the cheese, it's like, oh, Bra, why are they talking about bras? Okay, it's Bra in Piedmont. It's the centre of the slow food cheese, which happens every 2 years. It's a fantastic gathering of sort of cheese lovers from around the world. Sorry, so James and Sam were there at Bra.
Yes, they were there hosting the Great British and Irish Cheddar Challenge, which was a coming together of cheddars, and people bought a box of the cheddars. They were not labeled, so nobody knew which one it was, and they tasted along at home, and then everyone sort of voted on what their winner was. Anyway, throughout the weekend, James and Sam were talking a lot. I was at home with the babies. I was getting lots of text messages, but essentially we all feel very passionate about artisan cheese. Sam and I have worked in food and drink PR for the last 10 years, and we've really specialised in cheese. And what we know is that, you know, artisan cheesemakers, real cheesemakers, don't have huge marketing and PR budgets to tell their story. So when they're, you know, when they're sort of trying to convince people that you should be paying this much instead of what you can essentially get it for when it's mass produced, it's very difficult for them to put their point of difference across. So we all spent, you know, a lot of time throwing ideas about, you know, we were sort of thinking, let's start small. But then what we all sort of realized was that there's some really great organizations in cheese that are covering off the sort of trade side of things. You know, you've got the SCA, the Specialist Cheesemakers Association, the Academy, and the Guild of Fine Food. But there's a sort of missing wedge, pardon the pun, for consumers. And so what we want to do is fill that gap and help connect the cheesemakers and the cheese retailers with the consumers in a different way. So, you know, we're going to have a newspaper that we're going to send out, and it's going to be dedicated to cheese. And, you know, the difference with this newspaper is that we're not going to sort of be, even though it's going to go out nationally, it's not about you can buy this cheese nationally. This is a cheese that's got a great story. Go to your local cheese shop, your local deli, and ask questions about what sort of cheeses does this area have to offer, or do you sell a cheese like this because I've discovered it and I really like it. It's just sort of getting people to think differently about cheese. We've got organisations that are campaigning for bread, for ale, and with meat as well. You know, we've been talking a lot about like buying less, buying better, and I think the same applies to cheese.
Great point. Let me bring in James here, because you know, this is, as I mean, you made some very powerful, interesting points about that so much is linked to, you know, if we can support real cheesemakers, then you're also supporting ways of farming and our land. And in fact, we covered regenerative farming as a topic on this new series of the podcast a few weeks ago. So James, this is really interesting. And do you feel that there are lots of stories to be told that need to get out there? Cheese stories?
Oh my goodness, yes. Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, there are so many stories. And as champions of artisan cheese, retailers, good cheesemongers, it's our duty to spread that news and talk to our customers about that. However, there's not a large channel to make the noise to the public who aren't buying this cheese to start with, who don't understand that Andrew Hatton up in Nidderdale is planting the trees that originally grew on the landscape to avoid soil erosion, to feed his 60 head of cattle with the ingredients or the natural within the natural flora and fauna of the landscape has been put back together to produce one of the finest Wensleydales on the planet. We've got to really consider where we get our food from today. It's so important. Now is the time to make this movement happen. It's happened in bread, as Amy just mentioned. It needs to happen in cheese. And if we can act as another catalyst of change to help people realize, as I go back to Patrick Holden again, we are what we eat, what they ate. It's imperative that we start to understand our food. If we spend more money in our local communities on food, on cheese, on real bread, we're only going to be enriching the good people that work really hard and tirelessly to champion great produce and look after the land. The more times we do this, hopefully, we'll encourage that pendulum to swing in the right way.
Well, that is really interesting. I mean, and then, you know, you talked about, Amy, you pointed out about the marketing budgets. And that often people who are making cheese don't have big PR departments or the budgets. So then this new organisation, the Real Cheese Project, and obviously you have a huge experience, Amy, of PR, you and Sam. How is it going to fund itself then? Because that is it sounds like you're going to be putting lots of time and energy into it. But presumably you have to be paid for your time and knowledge. I'm guessing you will get to give a lot as well, but it has to make economic sense too. How's that going to happen?
The idea is that the Real Cheese Project for a consumer, for a cheese lover, is a new way to consume cheese. So there's going to be information in one place. You know, there's a lot of really interesting content out there about cheese. We're going to bring it all into one place, and we're going to have the newspaper, which is a subscription. Essentially, anyone, can subscribe to our newspaper. It will be delivered monthly. We will be making our money by selling our newspaper. So each month there will be a newspaper, and the leading story will be about a cheese that has got a really good story to tell, a very important story to tell. And there's an option within that subscription to have a sample of that cheese in the box as well. So again, it's getting lesser known cheeses out to a wider audience. Obviously, some are very small scale, so they, you know, we won't be able to do that. But the idea is that at home, you will receive a cheese that you can have a sample of. We will then direct people to go to their local independent deli, cheese shop, to buy more cheeses to fill out their cheese board. That is how the Real Cheese Project is going to make money. We've also got lots of other ideas about merch, going to events. We're redoing the Cheddar Challenge, but it's under a new name this year. So there's going to be lots of ways that we make money. And an important point is that 5% of our profits are going to go into a fund. And this is a fund that will be accessible for people in the cheese industry to access. And, you know, we're sort of still ironing out the details of that and how it looks. But we feel really passionate about the fact that, you know, if we can stop people having to close their doors because there's a pot of money to help them, you know, get a leg back up, or, you know, if there's training that's needed to keep the skills and the knowledge within the sort of artisan industry, then, you know, that's the sort of thing that we want to be facilitating.
Obviously, it does have to make money to keep going, because that's the world we're in. But equally, there's a lot of a desire to do good things, isn't there? I mean, and James, how are you finding, so you spend a lot of time, James, going around visiting cheesemakers, talking to them. What sort of response, I mean, have you discussed the idea of the Real Cheese Project? Do you think people will be receptive to what you are all trying to do?
Well, yeah, absolutely. We've spent months, more openly in the last two or three weeks. Actually, British Cheese Awards recently, we were talking to a few people about it, and we've been 100% welcomed by everybody. They love the idea. They want to support us. They want to see this work. We're not charging cheesemakers or retailers to be part of the Real Cheese Project. We are inviting them to be part of the movement in order for them to better sales, to better knowledge, and to better our planet at the same time. I think it's really important as well, just to hit on what Amy was saying a second ago, when we help people with our fund, we would like to be able to stick PR out, press releases out to the media when it comes to times of difficulty. There's been one highlighted over the Christmas period, of course, which we know all too well in Lancashire with Graham Kirkham. But for the PR, the press release to be able to go out almost instantaneously, we have the skill set between the four of us in order to produce a press release that tells the truth rather than fabrications that a lot of newspapers tend to like to embellish on to sell their press.
Yes, I mean, the sad thing is that, you know, something makes the headlines and then the actual reality of what really happened doesn't make the headlines. So a lot of damage can be done.
Cheesemakers, retailers don't have the budget for a PR company to send press releases out to, let alone where they go to the press releases and who they should be speaking to. So we have our finger on the pulse at all times. And it's not a single unit. We talk and collaborate with everybody else in the cheese world in order for the Real Cheese Project to work. I think gone are the days where we stand on the side and we do our thing. We need to all do the thing and work together to make this work. You know, if we can make some money from this, then great. But what I want to see and what the four of us want to see is that we make money for cheesemakers and retailers. And if we can make money off the back of that to enrich our families as well, then I'm happy to earn money from this. But I'm more happy to ensure that we protect something that's really important, which is our livestock, our farming communities, and the people that work really hard to sell it. It's really important we do this, and the time is now.
Yeah. Brilliant. Well, I think that's very stirring. And actually, can I just say that, you know, I've been writing about food for decades, and what is amazing is I've seen for myself, you know, the difference that people with an idea, with determination, with a vision can make. So I will obviously watch what you do with huge interest, and I wish you all you know, all the best. I think that idea of a joined up approach and being a voice for people who perhaps don't have a chance to get their story out, you know, very easily. And so if you can be a voice and speak on their behalf and engage the public, I think that's a brilliant idea. So I will, you know, I'm sure we'll have you back on the podcast again. So I wish you all the very best. Take care then. Thank you, James. Thank you, Amy. And good luck.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
To find out more about Food FM and our content, go to foodfmradio.com.
Thank you so much for listening to A Slice of Cheese. I hope you've enjoyed it. If you have enjoyed it, it would be lovely if you could rate us on wherever you've found this podcast. It will make such a difference to us. So I hope you'll enjoy us again. Thank you very much.